I am very delighted to be here today with CEW Green, Dr. Chris E.W. Green. And I'm going to have Chris introduce himself so that he can talk about that aspect of his work that might be relevant to what we're going to be discussing today.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to be with you again. I think I said this the last time that the EW is not just sheer pretension in my name. I mean, there's some pretension, I'm sure, but there are other Chris Greens and there are other Chris E. Greens and Chris W. Greens out there writing in theology. I was invited to give a paper once at a conference on my PhD work on Karl Barth and angels, which I did not write, but Chris E. Green did write.
Oh.
So that's why you get the double initials there. And I'm a theologian, a professor of public theology at Southeastern, which is just outside Tampa in Lakeland, Florida. I am a priest and a bishop in the Anglican tradition. So that's where I spend most of my time working and preaching and pastoral care, as well as doing theology, reading theology, teaching. I just finished a class. I'm sure his name will come up a lot today, but just did a theological ethics class at our seminary, reading through Bonhoeffer's Ethics. So yeah, that's what I do. And of course, a father and a husband and son and all of that as well. But it's good to be with you. Thank you for having me in.
Well, I and so much enjoyed speaking with you and listening to you when we did the conference together in Olympia, Washington, a couple of years ago. Hard to believe that's 2 years ago already. And at that time, we had talked quite a bit about just the structure of the universe and how things are put together, which is kind of my interest in this. And of course, it does coincide with theology at some point. So when you sent me some materials to get prepared, and you sent me Ambiguous 7 and Ambiguous 71 from Maximus the Confessor, and then you sent me an essay by Jordan Daniel Wood regarding wisdom, and then you sent me an essay by gentleman by the name of Brown discussing
William Brown is an Old Testament.
the cosmos as play. And they're all very difficult and they all fit together in just some amazing ways. So I want to provide a little bit of a framework. And so I'm going to start with a comment from end of Jordan Daniel Wood's essay, where he says that difference grounds union because creation is essentially the act of distending this very difference between created and uncreated nature, whose only claim to integrity is the pure will that there be two. And then he goes on to say, in Christ, hypostatic identity grounds both poles of the analogia entis, similarity and greater dissimilarity. So from this, I get that he's saying, and maybe necessary is a theological term that doesn't apply here. I don't know. I'm just using it as a layperson. It sounds to me as though he's saying two are in some way necessary. Would that be overreaching?
Well, I think no, not if you finish the sentence by saying two are necessary because this one is two. So Jesus is two. He is the divine and human one freely, and but this is who he is. We don't know who he is except as this one, the one who is, as the tradition will say, fully divine, fully human, son of God, son of man. And so I think as long as you say two are necessary because this one is two, then you are saying what Jordan is saying, which is what Maximus is saying.
However, where I think it creates problems for some people sometimes is that if you extend that to the creation as being necessary,
No, this is exactly right. Yes.
then do you run into problems?
Of course, but the problem, you really are faced with this choice very early on, maybe right at the very beginning of theology, with is there a system of reality into which Jesus fits, or is all of reality fitted to him? And at the end of the day, you're doing one or the other. And what Jordan is doing, following Maximus, and where certainly what I would want to do, is to say that the form of Jesus, and here I am going to use Bonhoeffer already, the form of Jesus Christ is the form reality takes freely, not necessarily freely, that this is who Jesus is, and therefore all things are what they are. He is, in the language of Paul, Jesus is all and in all. But I do think, yes, if you hear that as Jesus must, this one must be two because there's some rule that requires two, then yes, Jesus is not free. God is contingent upon creation, and we're not talking Christian theology anymore. But I would also say, if you say Jesus must be one, not two, because there is some rule to which he must answer, you're also not doing Christian theology. You just have a different form of contingency for God. And the point is, he's not contingent. He's personally free, hypostatically free. And he, in that freedom, is this. He doesn't want to be God without us. And of course, this is what not just Maximus, but the other fathers of the church are insisting upon at every turn, that he does not want to be without us. If he did, we wouldn't be at all. Like, we wouldn't exist at all. And it's why in that piece, Jordan, and not just in that essay, but in Jordan's book and his talk since that book, is insisting that creation and incarnation can't be neatly separated. We can't think of creation as one thing into which our incarnation comes as one instance of possibility. It is the ground of all things. Like, it is because Jesus is Jesus that anything and everything is what it is. And that I think is seems to me the right way to do theology, but it is really challenging, especially if we've started with assumptions about we know what, how kind of how reality works, and the question is just how do we make sense of Jesus in light of that preconceived notion of reality.
Well, okay, so the reason I got to thinking about this is that I read a quote in another context from a different writer, not one of the ones that you sent me. And I don't want to read the quote because the quote brings up a lot of other issues that are not going to be relevant to this. But what the quote made me think about is the issue of identification. And Jordan Daniel Wood uses that word identity quite a bit. In this quote, the thought came to me that there is a difference between, on the one hand, over-identification and under-identification, and then in between those two things would be the, not in between, but the third alternative would be covenantal union. So if we think of one of the things that Jordan Daniel Wood is talking about is the difference between pantheism and deism. So pantheism would be over-identification of Christ with the creation, in that they are one, that the creation and Christ would be inseparable. But then that would not allow for Christ to be bigger. Right. And then on the other side, there would be the deism side, which would be basically an under identification, that there's no connection between the two. But then the third alternative would be covenantal union, which would be, and in some way, I think there has to, it's very hard to put into words, but it's like the relation itself, the relationship itself is, I don't want to say that relationship is Christ, but the relationship itself is the focal point, maybe,
Yeah, I
the
mean,
covenantal union.
if we think in the language of Paul for a moment, he will say, right, that all things hold together in Christ. He holds all things together. And in Hebrews we'll use similar language too, right? That all things are gathered up in him. And this This is, I think, what you're pointing to, right? That this one who we call Jesus, this one we know as Jesus of Nazareth, is in fact the one who makes things what they are. Like, this is what Christian tradition means when it says he's the creator, and he's also the image of God, the image in who, you know, whose likeness Adam is made, humanity is made. So I think when we start to think along those lines, as Jordan is doing, following Maximus and others, we do get to this kind of wonder that is the beginning of thinking. And again, I've been teaching Bonhoeffer, so it's fresh on my mind, but Bonhoeffer will tell us, and I think he's dead right about this, that we can't get back behind the beginning of thinking. Right? Christ is the, for Christian thinkers, Christ is the premise of thinking. We start with him. And in his Christology lectures, Bonhoeffer will say that, you know, we can't ask how the incarnation is possible. We can only ask who is incarnate. And all hows and whys flow from who he is. And if you think there's some how that's bigger or some why that's bigger than him, that's what you should be worshiping, whatever that how and why is that's bigger than him. But that would be impersonal, and it wouldn't be the God of Christian faith. So I think the, you know, that's where the real, again, that's the, in the decision tree, that's the first choice. Do I think Jesus fits into some other construal of reality made otherwise than by him and for him? And if so, then I think we're off to something else. However much the language is Christian, we're not thinking Christianly if we think there is some form of reality into which Jesus is made to fit, that he didn't make, that he isn't making by being himself. But if we start with reality is what it is because Jesus is who he is, That's not going to be philosophically satisfying for people who don't share our faith, because it's premised on the faith we have in him. But I don't think there is such an answer. I don't think there is a philosophically knockdown answer to all things that is going to be, you know, kind of obvious to everyone and compelling for everyone. That doesn't mean, of course, we shouldn't be in dialogue about it. Of course we should. I mean, I think there's very little that's more invigorating than that kind of conversation. But I do think we have to kind of own what our commitments are, what our convictions are. And I think that's the kind of work you see Maximus and other church fathers undertaking, and that Jordan's holding up for us to see.
Well, so you're going to be talking to Ian McGilchrist in the fall here on the channel. And Ian McGilchrist is doing some very important work of trying to point out to the strict materialists some of the holes in their thinking. And he actually used that language the other day about how you can't get in behind reason without intuition, and that intuition and reason are inextricably linked. And but I sent you a video of him talking with Richard Watson and Michael Levin, who are both scientists. They're not pure materialists, but they are always looking for some kind of answer that doesn't include God. And I had a long conversation with Richard Watson last year, where he laid out his theory, and he has a very interesting theory that I think would be a way in which one could talk about who Christ is as reality. Richard Watson's idea is that life itself arises the way it does because it is inside of a song, and is responding to the harmonics of the song, and becoming more and more fitted to the song, and that's how life knows how to grow. And he goes in great depth into the scientific aspect of this and the musical aspect of it. And at one point in the conversation that I had with him, he says this thing that I think just really gets at the thing we started out with. So I'm going to share this.
Please.
I'm going to share this little bit. It's about 2.5 minutes long, and then maybe we can talk about it.
against an objective function versus harmonizing. That basic principle that I mentioned at the beginning of how natural selection works, of, you know, there's a function which tells you which things are good, right? And you picked up on that as something like, oh, so you assume that you have a function that tells you which things are good. And that's a weakness of the theory, because the things that are good, well, good for what? Good for this problem, good for this niche where the organism lives. But the niche where the organism lives was itself a mirror of the organism. It created that problem into which it lives, the niche, the problem it solves, the niche in which it lives. So, you know, the chord that suggests or summons an extra note to resolve it is, on the one hand, a problem that the additional note solves, but it's just as true that that chord, creates a context or solves a problem for that note, right? So you can have a sort of a back and forth between the context which summons the resolution and the resolution which summons the context, so that the idea of optimizing is just always flawed. It's always out of date. As soon as you try to optimize something, you're optimizing against the wrong thing, because it's
Because the
always a moving
context is
target.
always changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This being, I like to think of it sometimes in a different metaphor as a dance, being in the dance between the environment that I'm trying to model so that it doesn't surprise me so much, and the fact that it's just as valid to say that the environment is an agent that's trying to model me so that the environment isn't changed so much. We're both getting that wrong because we're playing catch up a little bit because of these lags, that I'm modeling what you did, but by the time I've got that right, you're doing something else because you're modeling what I did. And that dynamic is creating an ever-changing moving target, as it were. But if only one of you would stay still, the other one would be able to get it right. But then you would have missed the point. The whole point is that the beauty is in the mismatch, right? The beauty is in the tension that's created. The beauty is in the inability to reach an equilibrium, that back and forth, the dance of creating and resolving the tension. That's where the living is. That's where the life is. And as soon as you say, well, all other things being equal, this organism is fitter than that organism, it's like, yeah, but all other things aren't equal. They're always changing. We're always in a dynamic. That dynamic is responsible for creating the individual in the first place.
So maybe I'll stop there at this point. So do you have any thoughts?
Oh, I've got all kinds of thoughts. I mean, I don't know his work well. I've now seen the video you sent me plus this little clip. So
Yeah, well, you can't possibly know his work well because just to lay out his theory took 5 90-minute YouTube videos, which I watched probably 4 times each of them before I could grasp it. So
Yeah,
there's no way
there.
you could know the whole thing, but just if you just think in general about what a song is and how a song works, or maybe it's helpful to think of jazz because jazz isn't all written out in advance, but nevertheless, jazz can only function if all the musicians have some sort of a common framework that is, within which they're working, but then each one is responding to each other one, right? So there's this call and response going on all the time.
Yes.
Where I think this connects up with Maximus the Confessor, which I mean probably sounds weird, but let me see if I can find
No, I think all
this.
things connect with Maximus
Yeah.
at some point, just because he's thought so deeply and carefully about so many things.
So can you see this this page?
I can, yes.
Okay, so he's talking about rest and motion. And he says, if in the first place we accept that the divine is immovable, since it fills all things, whereas everything that has received its being ex nihilo is in motion, since all things are necessarily carried along towards some cause, then nothing that moves has yet come to rest because its capacity for appetitive movement has not yet come to repose in what it ultimately desires. For nothing but the appearance of the ultimate object of desire can bring to rest that which is carried along by the power of its own nature. And I made a little note there. The cord, in Richard Watson's comments, he says the cord presents a problem. The cord is calling forth a response. When you get to a certain place in a song, you know it has to lead somewhere. It wants to be resolved. So that chord presents a problem which needs to be resolved by the following note or chord, but at the same time, that chord solves a problem for the following chord because it provides for it a context in which meaning can arise. So there's this constant play of A causing B and B causing A, but in the interplay between the two, he talks about what he calls a viscoelastic structure. Now, viscoelastic is the difference between something that's fully elastic and something that is viscoelastic is that you could have if you have a spring connecting two points. If it's a perfect spring, you could stretch it and it would come right back to its original configuration. But no springs are perfect. They all, you pull it and when it comes back, it has changed a little bit. That's the viscoelastic nature of things that exist in the world. So if there is some sort of network that connects at any domain of reality, let's say one domain would be the way cells are connected in a living creature. Another domain would be the way people are connected in a society. And there is all these relations between people. And if these relations are somehow capable of being changed a little bit in the action of the two relations, then that little bit of change keeps things moving forward, always moving forward towards a final resolution. But there are little resolutions along the way, and that this song weaves everything together. I don't know. I'm going to stop there.
And well, leave that quote up and let me.
Okay.
I have like six or seven lines of thought, and I'll kind of lay some out, and you pick which one we take up. But one is a word of caution in thinking about these things through a metaphor like a song or a story or a dance. And I'm sure that he would agree with it. I mean, he himself in his comment to you shifted from talking about the song to the dance. So I don't think there would be any one metaphor that would be the perfect analogy for being. So we could talk about a song, but of course, that's going to raise the question of, are songs the same across cultures and times? And of course, they're not. I mean, what we think of as the harmonic scale has a history. It has a past and a beginning, and it will at some point have an end. I mean, a million years from now, I don't know what music will sound like. It'll still be music, but I don't know that it's going to sound like what my kids enjoy at this moment. It'll still have movement, though. And I think that whether we're talking about painting or dance or song, and we're talking about a song in our pentatonic scale or some other scale, and our sense of kind of our conventional sense of what's pleasing, there will be movement, there will be relationship. There will be a certain harmony and beauty to that movement and that relationship. that will yield ranges of meaning. And if we're right as believers, all of that is this really fecund gift that God has given, right? What he's calling not plastic, what was the term again?
Viscoelastic.
Viscoelastic. Like that kind of dynamism we must take as gift. In now that brings me to a next line of thought. Well, before I get to that line, notice here what Maximus says about things being carried along toward its cause. So I would think we would want, one of the things we would need to do is make a distinction between creation as something God alone can do, cause-effect relations, which we can study. We can't study creation. We can study cause-effect relations. And the difference between cause and effect relations as we have been taught to understand them. And of course, when I say we here, I'm talking about people like myself who are fairly intelligent and well read, but don't know, we're not scientists. Like I don't, that's not what I've given my life to. So I'm using it in a kind of amateurish sense, but still cause and effect as I've been taught to depend upon it, to think it, and other ways of thinking about cause. So right, Maximus clearly is thinking about final cause, the cause that is both the beginning and the end. It's the beginning because it's the end. What is the thing that brings the song to its final resolution? Well, that's why the song began in the first place. And for Maximus, the answer to all this is, well, Jesus is the beginning and the end, right? Like that is, and we're right back to where we started our conversation today. So I think that's another line of thought. Do we know the difference between creation and causation? And do we have an expansive enough sense of causation? And then I'll stop at three lines because we can get carried away here. But a third line of thought would be, how do we grapple with the ways in which creation, as we experience it, creation is both beautiful and it works? What he was saying there, what part of what really intrigues me is this notion that there's something that doesn't seem quite right, as he said, if either the environment or I would just stop, the other one could catch up. But there's this lag, this not catching up. And I'm probably misquoting him, but he said something to the effect of, but that's where the beauty is. That's where the life happens. And I think that's true, but it's not the whole truth. That's also where a lot of damage happens, that in that lag. And I don't think we want to simply collapse together the damage and the beauty. And we also don't want to make them dependent upon each other some straightforwardly dualistic way. So I think we need a way of thinking that suggests the world just doesn't work quite right. And that tells us something significant. I mean, for Christians now, we're gonna come to language of fall and evil and sin and death. But there is still something good and beautiful happening in that not quite rightness. We don't want to too quickly dismiss all of it as somehow broken, which is a term I think we throw around much too freely. So I think there are kind of two mistakes we want to avoid if we're thinking about the way things are and why they work the way that they do. One is, and it's, I think, pretty closely analogous to what you were getting from Jordan, which is there's a kind of over-identification or under-identification. So there's one way of thinking about the way things work that simply says, well, that's the way God made it to be. However things happen, that's the way God made it to be. It must be good. Or there's no purpose at all in it. It just happens to be that way. Like the kind of extreme materialist account of things that is just how it happens, and it's sheer accident. So I think we need some way of thinking in which the way things work or seem to work is somehow both good, but not the good that was meant for us and that is actually drawing us toward fulfillment. So I think obviously that's the very first step toward a very long walk, in a very long walk. But those are the kind of my initial first three thoughts. And I'm happy to take up any of those or something else, wherever your mind goes.
Well, let's address the last one first. in this matter of being drawn towards something. are we done with the quote now?
Well, what I mainly wanted to point out from the quote is the way in which he's showing us a more expansive vision of causation. We're being drawn. Yeah, we're being drawn.
Because he says it has not yet attained its ultimate desired end, because that which can arrest the motion of whatever is moved in relation to it has not yet appeared. And of course, that's filled with all sorts of biblical references.
Well, and can I say this too, a fourth line of thought, Karen, that I think is going to come up a lot today. I think there is a kind of recognition. I think you and I have discussed this before. We might have discussed it the last time we talked and on this channel. This Chesterton's statement about if you were studying a human being in abstract, if you didn't know what a human being is, and you said a human being has, well, two ears and two eyes, and two hands and two feet, two lungs, two nostrils, you would pretty quickly assume, well, how many hearts does it have? Well, two, because we've got all these other twos at play. Or how many mouths does it have? Well, two, and so on. How many heads does it have? It's like, well, that's, as it turns out, that's not what a human being is, right? And I do think sometimes in these conversations, we're kind of following probabilities in abstraction, but not recognizing the reality, which is always surprising. So the way things actually are is always more surprising than any abstraction, no matter how complex. By the way, I think this is what is so frustrating about so many conversations about AI and language models and so on, is that those are essentially strings of numbers and abstractions, and they can't recognize the strangeness of reality that's there because of this liveliness that emerges that isn't. And that, of course, was coming through in the conversation you had me watch of the three of them talking, that they're looking for, you know, where is all of this information stored? Well, it's not information. It's not information. It might, once it's appeared, you might then try to retroactively think of it as information and then ask, well, where did it come from? And once it's there, there is an informational dimension to it, but it's getting there wasn't informational. It's coming there somehow, happens, it emerges, it's a surprise. And so I think so many of these conversations are bedeviled by that, like that what we need more than anything else is recognition. This is the way the world actually works. And now, how do we think that? We can't think our way to recognition, though, if we don't actually recognize.
Yeah, I mean, how many problems would be resolved if everybody understood that this is the way reality works? Yes. You know, we don't even begin to get even the tiniest grip on that until we're probably in our at least late 20s or early 30s, that there is a way that the world is. And yeah, so coming back to this idea of being drawn towards, the reason that Richard Watson came up with this theory in the first place is he's trying to solve a problem. Yes. And the problem is all the holes in the theory of natural selection. And one of the holes in that theory was discovered by Michael Levin, because Michael Levin does this work with planaria, these little worms. And that got him started to thinking about the way all organisms develop from the embryonic stage. And let's just take a human being as an example, although this is a very sophisticated example, but you could also look at a frog. The starts out as a little blastula of cells. Well, you know, the egg I don't know if a frog, if it's an egg and a sperm, but with a human being, it's an egg and a sperm, and they unite, and then it starts proliferating cells. And at the beginning, those are all undifferentiated cells, but then at a certain point, it divides so that it becomes bilateral. And then at a certain point, the arms start to form, the legs start to form, and we get this two-ness that you're talking about. And the question that Michael Levin started thinking about is when it grows the arms and then the fingers, how does it know when to stop? How does it know how long the fingers should be? And with is it a salamander that will regenerate a limb?
Yes,
You
that's
can
right.
cut the limb off and it will regenerate, and the limb that is regenerated is exactly the same length as the limb on the other side. And yet that information is not in the DNA, is not in the genes. So where is that okay, you can think of it as information or you can think of it as form.
Yes.
Where is that form residing? Or is it a memory of a form? This is the problem that Richard Watson was trying to solve. And so he's thinking that perhaps there's some sort of memory that forms out of this way in which harmonics affects matter in the world, and that these harmonics are leaving a residue in the matter, which is very much like being drawn towards something. Now, when you think of a song, you don't have to think of a particular kind of song or that it's a pleasing song or that it's culturally relevant song or anything. You can just think of a song as being something that has a beginning and is moving towards some end. And these harmonic relationships affect the way that. And then he talked about the place, the leg is where the life happens. And I thought what you said there was so interesting because his concept of the lag being where the life happens, I think, fits rather nicely into another framework from Jordan Peterson about his picture of the universe, which is obviously incomplete, is that it's composed of order and chaos. And then there's an edge between order and chaos, and all the interesting things happen on that edge between order and chaos. Because he says, if you want to live an adequate life, you need to have one foot in order where you're stabilized with what reality is. And then if you fall over into chaos, or if you are called over into chaos to help somebody else, you have to be able to reach into chaos. And when you're there, you have to be able to say somehow in yourself, what is there of value or beauty here that I'm supposed to take with me? So chaos is not just the bad stuff. There is also a lot of beautiful things in chaos. I kind of think maybe the chaos is just all sorts of creative potential. And it depends on your perspective as to whether you see it as something bad or something good. Be that as it may.
Yeah, so it's so much of this is so fascinating. So I think there probably are any number of things that are getting grouped under that word chaos when we hear it. And this is to your point, right? Is it chaos or is it just a complexity that I haven't caught up to yet? Is it chaos because it's building toward a beauty that hasn't arrived at yet? So it might just be, it's not truly chaos. It is coherent. I just don't have the ability to perceive it because it's too big or too fast or it's too new. So that's one possibility. And then another possibility is it is chaotic in this moment, but it's chaotic because something is coming together. Something is happening that once it's come together, now I see. It wasn't chaotic at all. It was building. It was setting me up and preparing for that reveal that's going to, or it might be chaos because something is coming apart. It was coherent. It had a kind of harmony, however complex, and I'm now catching it perspectively. I'm catching it as it's coming apart. But I also do think there are things that are chaotic. I think there's all of this, like there's beauty that's too big, fast, or new for me. There's beauty that's building. There's beauty that's coming apart. But then there is evil in the world. There is gone wrongness. Where there is stuff that's bad, that's gone bad, that's become rotten. And I don't think that it's irredeemably so, because again, we're talking about the God for whom nothing is impossible. But I do think we're going to need at least all of those categories on the table to even really start talking about what we mean by chaos, you know. And
interestingly, Peterson relates order and chaos to the masculine archetype and the feminine archetype. Not in the sense of that we think in the world of masculine, feminine, but in the sense of the potentia and the materia, I guess. Yeah. Right. So, and that's not even exactly right. but there exists a good order and a bad order. There exists a good chaos and a bad chaos. So the good order would be the eternal father, the good king who establishes a good order that has some potential for flexibility in it. The bad order would be the tyrannous king, the tyrannical father that just lays down the law and there's no room for any sort of growth or anything. On the other side, you have the eternal mother that's fecund and filled with potential and beauty and surprise and all of that. Yes. And then on the other side, you have the bad mother that is, what's the word he uses? Using the compassionate control using compassion as a way of controlling others, yeah. Right? So, and that fits into this matrix of order and chaos. But what to me has always been interesting about this whole picture is that the line between order and chaos is where, for example, if you have two microclimates that come up against each other in a certain area, and California is filled with these microclimates, that a lot of the diversity and creativity that's happening in the soil and in the creatures and the plants and everything is happening right along the edge between those two microclimates. Mm-hmm. So there is something about this when these two things are coming together. And to me, it looks very much like a marriage. Mm-hmm. So McGilchrist is always talking about the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And if you break it down, roughly speaking, the left hemisphere is this ordered side and the right hemisphere is the more creative, not creative necessarily, but open to exploration side of the brain. But that happens to be pretty much the picture of my marriage. So my husband is the very ordered guy with preconceptions about how things work. And then I tend to be the more exploratory, you know, well, let's hold on a second. Let's think about this. Maybe there's more there, you know? So the marriage is where the creative ideas come. So if the two of us are willing to set aside our differences and actually look at a problem, we come up with more creative solutions together. And I think this is the same thing as the covenantal union, as opposed to the over-identification and the under-identification. So right. It's way possible to be under-identifying to where things are just coming apart, which would be total chaos, which would be me being way too exploratory, accepting mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, the over-identification and the too orderly and all of that. Does Absolutely. That make sense?
It does. And the way that I would think, you know, before I get to my real response, just a footnote on that. You may have heard Martin Shaw talk about this very similar image that, you know, we live in Camelot and Sherwood. You know, we have the King Arthur stories and we have the Robin Hood stories, and we need both of these myths. And we need to know how to order our lives in the city and in the forest. And mm-hmm. I think that's similar, another way of talking about the same, which I love. I love that image. But you know, you're talking to a priest and a theologian. So I think for me, it's not so much like the line between order and chaos that Peterson is talking about is to me about maturity. maturity being able to hold all that together and to live at that border. And I think we need to learn to live there. I think you said an adequate life requires that kind of maturity. But I do think that that is still, theologically speaking, that's still not what we're meant for, because that line depends upon that whole matrix. It depends upon the bad, the gone wrong, not just the other or the chaotic in the good sense, but the chaotic in the bad sense. And so thinking theologically, God's creativity does not arise from those conditions. God's creativity doesn't arise from conditions at all. And the conditions God means to make for us don't derive from what becomes possible in the conflict. Like, I think this is the wisdom of Israel's creation story over against so many ancient creation myths. There's no conflict there. God is not overcoming something or generating conflict in order to create something. One of my favorite stories in scripture is the story of Ruth, in which you have drama, but you don't have conflict. You don't have characters that are opposed to other characters creating drama. And I think what we're meant for, that final end that is rest, that Maximus is talking about, is what we see in Christ, which is wisdom, not maturity. So I think maturity is, we don't live in, the song's not over yet, to stay with that metaphor, right? We're not at the final rest. So now we have to have maturity. We have to hold together. We do live on that line. Hopefully we live on that line and don't, you know, flee into order or flee into chaos, if we can stay with that image. But what we're meant for is wisdom, which is the integration of opposites and the overcoming of all that is opposed to good and to life and to joy. And I think that's, thinking theologically, that's what we see in Jesus. Like, we see him having not just maturity, although of course he's mature, but he's wise. He's able to bring it together in a way that is something like a higher harmony. There's a convergence, an integration that doesn't leave us with chaos. It does leave us, I think, with creativity, or what we might call creative chaos, right? And this is why play is, I think, exactly the right way to talk. That in play, there is a lot of disorder, but I would say that that's not fallen disorder. Right now in the world, as you and I know it, the way the world works, we can't pull those apart. We can conceptualize them as distinct, but experientially, we can't pull them apart. But what we're hoping for is a kind of healing of all things that brings about a wholeness, a shalom. I think this is what is meant by the kingdom of God, in which there is integration and convergence, in which there's still creativity, there's still movement, there's still, you know, the emergence of order and new orders that are beautiful and delighting, but there isn't evil and there isn't gone wrongness. Maturity holds us in place while we're waiting on that wisdom to arrive. And I think we have flashes of that wisdom, but really we see it, we only see it fully realized in Jesus. And I think that the thinking in that way, by means of play, or using play as a way of thinking about all that, I think is our, it's actually the, what frees us up to recognize what's actually going on. I was talking with my daughter last night about how healing, even of those, and especially perhaps of those wounds that are deepest in us, often happen in moments that are light. And I love in English how when we talk about something being light, we might mean something illuminated and illuminating, or we might mean something that's funny. We might mean something that's not heavy, right? Something that has levity to it. And that, again, that's what you get in play. You get something that is illuminating precisely because it's not too heavy, and it's light in all the right ways. And so I think that's another, like, a crucial part of understanding how we are going to come to recognize what's actually going on.
Part of the reason I think about this stuff all the time is I have I don't have the brain that Dr. McGilchrist has, or his staying power in writing books, but But I do have the same desire that he has to try to speak into the scientific community. And so let me play with this idea a little bit so that
Please.
it might help me in being more articulate about these ideas. If we think about play, the creative aspect of play and the play being wisdom and being fully realized in Jesus and all of those things. There is an aspect of play that is not possible unless there are some rules of the game. Because if you don't have some sort of a structure or some sort of a goal, least humanly speaking, we get completely immobilized. If there are too many options, we get immobilized. And so in order to have a reasonable game to play, you have to have some sort of structure.
I
Does
think
that
that's
help you?
right. I think that's right. Although I would also say that there are times in which the structure might be very, very, very simple, which is just we decide we're going to do something together, and then a new structure emerges from it, right? So, like, I want to leave room for the that what I called a moment ago, creative chaos, you know, where there's a beauty building, and if you froze it, if you froze that movement, it would look like nothing's happened yet. There are no rules here. But you're freezing the movement. Like if you let the movement go, it will reach a point which now looking back, you can realize, oh, it was building toward this. So I think, you know, as kids, often we invent games as well as play them. And the inventing does start with some kind of basic structure, even if it's just us being put in a play yard together. Are given an amount of time to play, or, you know, like we get put in a sandbox. And so there's some structure there, yes. And because I think to be human is already to exist in some givenness, like that we don't ever have a moment of our lives where there's not givenness there. But I do think that very often that givenness can be very bare, very slim.
Well, except that givenness includes all of the physical laws that we are subject to
Of course,
as
yes.
well,
And it's
and all
well
of
there.
the material resources that are available to us, and all, I mean, all of that is part of that givenness.
Definitely.
So I saw this video the other day about this dog making his own fun. The dog has a ball and he's at the train station and he runs up the stairs with the ball in his mouth and then he lets the ball go and he runs down to the bottom of the steps and the ball bounces down. Okay, part of the reason that that's fun for the dog is that where the ball goes is not something that can be predicted. It can only be anticipated. The surprise is what makes it fun. Is it going to bounce here or is it going to bounce there? Right? And that's what makes it fun for the dog.
Absolutely.
Because when a human being throws the ball at the dog, that's not predictable for the dog. So there's always going to be surprise. And that's part of what makes play fun, right? So it seems like at a minimum for play to be fun, there has to be an element of anticipation.
Yes.
And I'm going to try a big thing here. I don't know if it's going to work. I've been fascinated for at least the last year with Genesis 1, verse 9, where it talks about God gathered the waters so that the dry land might appear. And the word gathered there is only translated as gathered in that location. Everywhere else in the Bible, it's translated as hope or wait or endure. There it's translated gathered. So I've been thinking about this. And then if you look a little bit deeper into the Hebrew, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I mean, I have access to all these online tools. If you look a little deeper into that word gather, it has within it the concept of tension or a twisted cord. And then you can follow that thread through the whole scripture and you run into a whole lot of interesting things that are related to this
Yes.
cord. So it's like the waters are gathered up and the dry land appears. And in my mind, there's some connection between that and faith is the substance of things hoped for.
Yes.
And the thing hoped for is the thing that is anticipated. So lately, I've been having conversations with some AI researchers and related to how language structure is a very mysterious thing, how the AI relates to language structure and just how language structure is very mysterious for us as well. But also an economist who's been thinking about many of these issues and how even the way cells are operating conform to certain economic principles.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the difference between anticipation and prediction. And I don't know if that's a thread you'd be interested in following.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. In fact, the way I was using the word recognition before is to try to get at this exact same point. So I would want to make a distinction between complexity and mystery, as well as I said before, a difference between causation and creation. So I don't think we can study the creative act per se in terms of the work of God. We can't know that in itself. We can study cause-effect relations, but when we do, we find there not only complexity, we find mystery. And I think what you're calling anticipation and distinguishing from prediction is naming mystery as something distinct from complexity. So I think if you have a closed system, no matter how complex it is, at some point you can master predictive accounts of it. Because if you can get all that complexity gathered into a system, into a model, and you really have it all there, there's no mystery left. And this is part of the reason I think in English we can talk about solving a mystery. Because we really think mystery is just a complexity we haven't fully modeled yet. But what I'm saying, and I don't know if this is quite what McGillicuddy is saying, but I think it is. I think it is what he's saying. That is that there is mystery in the created order too. And notice how I'm distinguishing that from what God is doing. For a lot of people, you know, at least in my world, mystery is a name for the interventions of God into the complexity of created order. So like human life is complex and God sometimes intervenes and does stuff that you can't catch up to, miracles. And that's where the mystery is. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying God is always working, and what God is doing, we can't track. It's God's doing. But that the world that God has brought about, is bringing to an end, is a world in which there are complexities of various scales, but there are also mysteries. There are things that emerge, that happen, that are playful, that they are anticipated, perhaps, but they cannot be predicted. And you can only know them by recognizing them. That happened. This is somehow happening. So I don't think there will be, and I know, but this puts me at odds with lots of folks for lots of reasons, but I don't think there is a theory, a model that could ever catch up to all that the world is. I don't think it can be fully mapped, because I think some of what we would be trying to be mapped is by its very nature unmappable. And it's not a failure of our mathematical models, it is a grace that's in the nature of things themselves. And we're trying to solve something that's actually irresolvable because it's grace. It is what brings life. It is liveliness. It's joy and the source of joy. It's where the fun is, as you said. So that's at least kind of where I'm coming from. I think that is resonating with what you're saying, but you know, you tell me if I'm mishearing you somehow.
Well, what you just said makes me think about the thing that led me on this kind of led me on this journey to start with, to start the channel 6 years ago, was that I had just finished reading Jordan Peterson's book, Maps of Meaning. And I believe it's chapter 3 or 4 in Maps of Meaning, he discusses anomaly, the meaning of anomaly, and all the different scales of anomaly and where anomaly appears in the world, and you know, whether it's a gigantic disaster anomaly or a very small thing that happens in your life. Roughly speaking, the idea is you're trying to get from A to B, and you have a goal, you're going to get to B. Some anomaly occurs, which prevents you from reaching your goal. Maybe it kicks you all the way into chaos. Maybe it's just a small irritation. At that point, when the anomaly occurs, you have to adapt one way or another. And so anomaly produces, in some sense, anomaly produces adaptation. Mystery works that way too, right? I started thinking, because with a lot of these scientists, you can drive them into a corner, but the question that they can never answer is, well, where does the anomaly come from? Because there's always something that's not predictable. They like to talk about, oh, you're that's a God of the gaps argument.
Right. And that's precisely what I was trying to speak to.
Yeah. It's not a God of the gaps argument. It's just that, why is it that the anomaly that produces the adaptation always seems perfectly suited to the adaptation that's needed at the moment? Mm-hmm. And so, and this, I think, gets me in trouble, probably theologically, but it seems to me also that some of the bad things that exist in the chaos that I fall into really do produce an adaptation in my life that's a benefit to me. And Definitely. So they're a gift of some kind, even though they were irreducibly bad.
Yes.
Not that it was a good thing, you know, like all things work together for, they're not all good, but they all work together for the good of those who are called according to his purpose.
I think that's right, Karen. And I think that part of, you know, the two lines of thought immediately for me, two strong lines of thought. One is, what if we're asking some questions that are themselves not only unanswerable, but misleading? Like, I think that we have to take that more seriously. And I think McGilchrist is as good as anyone at putting that pressure back on us. And in various ways, showing us that that's not the right question to be asking. So I think there's that. But there's also this way in which, and what I mean by that is something like, if you ask me, why do I love my children? And you push me for some kind of answer, you have to tell me why you love them. Every attempt I have at answering that is going to lead us closer to a misunderstanding of love. So like, if you ask me first, you know, why do you love your children? I mean, I'm going to have an initial kind of response. Oh, Zoe's delightful for this reason, and Clive's delightful for that reason. And that's fine enough, but that's not why I love them. Mm-hmm. I see that about them because I love them, actually. I don't love them for that reason. It's not as if they didn't have that, I wouldn't love them, right? It's only because I love them that I can see that and delight in it the way that I do. But if you keep pressing me, no, I want to know why you love them. And I try to get back behind that. Every move I make to get closer to the reason is actually getting me further away from the truth of what it is, which is, I love them because they're my children. They were given to me, and so was the love for them. It's just there. And I don't have a reason. If I did, it wouldn't be the gift it is. And I think that's true of the ball bouncing down those steps, as well as my children and my love for them. And I think that really, that's the truth of everything. And if you're insisting on, no, there has to be some reason, you're going to get further from the mystery of being, which again is not the God of the gap. So that's one line of thought. The other is that, I think, well, do you want to respond to that before I go to the, because that.
Well, just because that's such a beautiful illustration of the idea that you said earlier about givenness. Givenness is not only all the physical laws to which we are subject and all of the limitations of the physical resources that we have to put anything together, but givenness is also in this mysterious realm of I'm given this child and I'm given the love for this child. And maybe you could break it down to oxytocin and serotonin and whatever. Mm-hmm. But then why is there oxytocin? Why is there serotonin, right? I mean, it all goes to this idea of givenness, that there is a way that reality is, and there is a way that we can live within that reality that results in gratitude and humility, that makes the givenness something that is beautiful,
yes,
rather than something that is just challenging.
That's right. And that gratitude and humility language, that's the key. But that, so when we get the chance to talk to McGilchrist, one of the things I want to test with him is the way that I've come to talk about his work in my classes, which is that they're kind of these two modes he talks about, these ways of attending. I've come to call grasping mode and glorying mode. And grasping mode is the mode of problem solving, tool using, and ultimately weapon wielding. And I actually think a lot of Israel's stories are stories about that, stories about how once you start using tools, you eventually become a weapon wielder, because there's a mode you're not meant to get stuck in. We're actually meant to live in glorying mode, which is open, but not passive. It's aware, it's attending, it's responsive. It's able to respond to reality as reality is given. And it responds with gratitude, with awe, with grief. Like it weeps with those who weep. It rejoices with those who rejoice. It's responsive in that dynamic living way. You know, when it sees the ball bouncing down the steps and the dog chasing it, it laughs because it recognizes that joy for what it is. But grasping mode is a necessary mode that has to fit inside of glorying mode. You got to shift in and out of it. And if you get stuck in grasping mode, then you start asking questions like, well, why do you love your kids? Why do you love God? Why do you love your spouse? Why do you love yourself? And so on. And you start to, you get stuck in a mode that's actually not livable, right? And it will undo your humanity and strip you of humility, gratitude, make it so that you can't respond to reality. In fact, the longer you're stuck in that mode, I think the more violent you become, the less graceful. And you get marching instead of dancing. But I want to test that with McGilchrist and see, you know, how he would push back and reshape it. But I found that with my students, as a way of getting them to read him or listen to him, it is a helpful, it's at least a helpful initial conversation for them to get to his work, which is some of what I want them to do, some of what I mm-hmm. want them to be. And it does provide some really interesting ways of reading stories like the stories of Cain and Abel that are, in some ways, about the difference between which mode we live in and what we're trying to do in our life. And if we're mostly living in fix it problem solving mode, what happens to us? Like what's the fruit of that? Like what are the outcomes? And I think that's pretty clear. When you think in those terms, you get some pretty compelling evidence that in the short run, when there's still playfulness mixed in with the fixing, you get exploration, you get discovery, you get invention. But if you stay in that mode too long, you move past the playfulness, you get deconstruction, you get decreation, you get dehumanization, you get a meddling with things that aren't ours to meddle with, and you move past creative invention that serves into we've got to do it because we can think to do it. We can do it, so it has to be done. And I think we end up inventing tools we shouldn't invent and weapons we shouldn't invent. And we become what we get into what Ivan Illich calls the counterproductive. We become too productive. We do too much. And so I think some of it is like just shift out of that mode for a while, like come back to your natural state live there until there's playfulness again and tenderness. And I love this line from a Charles Peguy poem, all life comes from tenderness. And you
I noticed that you just wrote a book with that title.
Yeah. It's a collection of sermons that have that title. One of the sermons is called, but it's from a Peguy poem. And the in fix it mode, you lose tenderness. Now, early on, it's there. Like, and I think this is why, you know, when we think of the scientists that move us, we're talking about their work that's creative and playful and exploratory and inventive, allowing us to see reality differently, bringing us up against. So this is not a kind of science, religion, faith difference. That's not what I'm talking about at all. But that if you get stuck in that mode, then it ends up stripping you of all that joy that is life and all of the fun of even that work. Like even the work you're doing starts to become lifeless. And I think, that is a way at least of kind of getting squaring up to McGilchrist's project.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to when that happens. I was thinking about your whole discussion there about tool using, and it made me think about the medium is the message and the limitations of communication. And the reason I was thinking about that is that in, I think it's Jordan Daniel Wood's essay at the end, he is talking about the places where he wants to try to bring together Maximus and Hans Urs von Balthasar in an area where it seems like it's impossible to bring them together, but because he wants to honor both of their ways of thinking, he's trying to find a way to bring them together. And I thought, okay, this is a perfect example of the medium being the message, because that made me think about how, like in philosophy, all the new philosophies depend upon this kind of standing on the shoulders of giants that has gone on before. But every theologian seems to have to go back and contend with Maximus. Mm-hmm. Maximus was just one guy, right? Yes. But because of the experience that he had with God, and he wrote down what he learned from that, everything that has been written since then, that and that's only possible because it got written down, right. even if it had only been passed on through memory, through oral tradition, it still created something that everyone afterwards has to contend with. And that means that is it possible for there to come along some new person who has an experience with God and write something that is not somehow always contending with Maximus? And on the philosophy side, we find that so much modern philosophy got kind of waylaid by Descartes and by Kant and got us off into this place where we are now, where we're dividing everything up into the smallest possible pieces and trying to say that that's where the meaning resides.
Right.
So how do you deal with that limitation of communication and not letting the medium control the direction? I mean, it happens to be that Maximus had good things to say.
Yes.
What if we were building our whole foundation on something that was not like that?
Well, and I that's part of what I mean by if you're reading Maximus in fix-it mode, like if you're in that mode of pulling things apart to see how they work and you're stuck in it, it becomes destructive and it's no longer playful. It's cruel. And what we do to the atom, we do to the theologian, we do to the philosopher, we do to the human being. And I think that part of what we have to recognize is the only proper way to read anyone, including Maximus, is from this mode of playful, humble, thankful openness to the truth, not to their project, but to the truth. And we're dialoguing with them because we've bumped into them and they're a voice that's helping us see the truth. And there's a playful back and forth And of course, there's respect. There's, I'm not Maximus, so I mean, I'm going to defer to him on a lot of this. But what I'm deferring inside that dance, or to go back to the image from earlier, it's a song that's happening, that's playing out, and I want to harmonize with it, but not slavishly repeat it. And I think that it kind of doesn't matter whether you're talking about, the worms, or you're talking about the work of Saint Augustine. If you're in a fix it mode, you're going to be slavish. You're going to be tool using to the point that you become a tool. Aristotle defines a slave as a living tool. You become a slave of your own technology, including your own methods. And at that point, you lose life, you lose joy, even in the work you're doing. And instead of discovery, now you're taking things apart. You're dismantling. And we want to unveil, we want to discover, but we don't want to dismantle. Like, we don't want to rip things. We don't want to destroy their life. And I mean, I see this every day, of course, and I'm at risk of it every day, destroying someone's work, Maximus's or anyone else's, because I'm trying to make it be something for me it isn't supposed to be. I'm handling it. There's the key word. I'm handling it in a way that's false to it. It's a betrayal of it. And I think what Jordan's doing well, and part of what he's showing you, is, oh yeah, we can do this. It may seem impossible, but let's try it. Let's play at it and see if we can. And that seems to me to be the right way to do theology, because it's the right way to live, right? It's the right way to do physics as well, not just theology.
Yeah, a thought occurred to me while you were talking, and then it flew away. So that's why I have that deer in the headlight look on my face. Yeah.
I talked too long. I should have stopped. I should have seen that you were seeing something and stopped.
No. I mean, it came and went so fast. You were talking about, oh, the tool using. I know what it was. I was wondering if you had any thought. The thought that came to me is that, the verse where it says both. There's one verse that says, and then the pruning hooks shall be turned into swords, and then there's another one that says where the sword shall be turned into pruning hooks. Do you have any thoughts on that as related to
Absolutely.
this idea of tool using?
Absolutely. Well, because I think big picture, what we have with Cain is a farmer who murders his brother, who, over the course of the fact that what he's trying to make happen with his tools won't happen, he turns against his own. And that image from the prophets of, in the end, what's going to happen is we're going to beat our spears and swords back into pruning hooks and plowshares, is a sense in which we're going to go back to the place in which we are going to be people who work the ground. But we're not going to turn that against our brother, but to serve them. So, like, the difference between using the tool to get something for myself to use against someone else. Like, that's what in the Christian tradition, Jewish tradition, we're going to talk about as sin. But to use a tool to bring forth a gift that I offer, like, that's healing, that's grace. And I think the image I sometimes use in class is the relationship between the farmer and the priest. The priest has no bread and wine to offer in the Eucharist if there isn't a farmer to bring that bread and that wine. And not just the farmer, but whoever takes the grain and makes the bread, right? And the, not to use stereotypes, but the farmer and the farmer's wife together bringing this bread and this wine to the priest to offer it. And the thing itself is meant to have that whole story. The farmer needs to be farming, the bread has to be made, the wine has to be made from the grapes. Now we're ready to bring that, and it has to be offered. And not till it's offered and consumed with joy, with thanksgiving, to use the words you used before, is the story of what was in that field told. And in one way, human beings are there to get that story told, like, as well as it's there for us and our story to get told. But all of that has to happen. And I think a lot of us, when you're a farmer who has no priest, or a farmer who has no wife, in the analogy I'm using here, then at some point you become violent. At some point you start to destroy the earth. You start to destroy your neighbor. You start to claim their land and so on. And like that's where we start to lose our, and that's what I mean by getting stuck in that mode, in grasping mode, where you're putting your hands on everything. So the way I'll sometimes say it to students is, if you're stuck in grasping mode, you start to handle everything, but you're not in touch with reality. And it's only in glorying mode that you're actually in touch with reality, and you can live with touch because your hands are open. My daughter, she just finished doula training. And one of the things they told her in the training was, you can't catch a baby with closed hands, with fists. And I think that's really what we're talking about here. There's a way of living that's closed, that's fisted. And there might even be moments when you have to have closed hands. You have to be fisted, but you can't live there. And if you live there, you miss the mystery, you miss the liveliness, you miss the joy. And then your work, whatever it happens to be, whether it's physics or theology, will start to become violent, because it will die. You will die in the doing of it. And that's what I think the Cain story is. Like, this is what happens when your work is cut off from playfulness and cut off from gratitude and cut off from humility. It works against you.
Well, and not to get myself in too much trouble, but that also seems to be the direction that, at least according to some people, Protestantism has gone in, that direction of taking everything apart and very tool oriented and very grasping oriented in terms of propositional ideas. And
absolutely. That's a perfect example. I think that, you know, systematic theology can be all about the pieces and how you put them together, or it can be a way of standing before the whole. And everything depends on what you mean, right? And I think that the goal is to be able to stand there present to the whole. Like, that's what you want. And because I think that's the glory mode we're meant to live in. Now, sometimes to do that, you've got to be able to shift into that other mode so you can work with the pieces to show the whole. I mean, you know, piecing the mosaic together or whatever it may be. But you can't live there. At some point, you got to step back and see what's been shown to you. And so I think, again, life is in many ways the painter stepping forward to paint. I mean, you would know this better than most. And then stepping back to see, how's it going, right? Is that working? And maybe not. I got to step close again, and I got to work. I got to try a little bit different shade here, or a little bit different shape here. And then I step back and see the whole. But it's your capacity to see the whole and to let it work on you that actually should guide what happens when you step close, right? And if it doesn't, your work, it's just paint by numbers. No matter how impressive it may be, it's just paint by numbers. If it doesn't arise from this sense of your ability, or what happens when you step back and see, that's what's happening. This is what's coming together. And if you have that, then when you step close for that little work, that fine work, there's joy in it. Because it is a participating in that larger frame. So I think, and the same thing with music or poetry or dance or love and love making, like it's everything in human life, like that. Mm-hmm. Cooking a meal, like eating a meal, like all of it comes to this same dynamic.
Well, I was thinking about this in terms of the issue of Protestantism, because we've had an experience very recently where we just stumbled into a church. I was invited by one of the gals that worked there because I happen to know her, and it's a Presbyterian church, but they do their entire service with the liturgy. And I had been looking for an Anglican church because I knew Anglican churches had the liturgy, and I had not experienced that way of worshiping before, aside from having visited a Catholic church and an Orthodox church in the past, but it wasn't, because I was just visiting, it wasn't my experience. But we've gone now 6 times to this church, and it occurs to me, after the awe and wonder and mystery and all the beauty of it and everything else, that that this could be the way forward for ecumenism that doesn't require any denomination to give up its, let's say, appropriate. I know there are distinctives that are useless, but there may be some appropriate distinctives. But if we were all centered together around the liturgy and all having that same experience, that would draw all the believers together in this wholeness, standing before the throne. Yes. And then that made me think about the problem of all the young people that aren't getting married and that can't find a mate. Mm-hmm. That if all the if these churches that are centered around the liturgy could start having, let's say, quarterly festivals where all the churches could gather, where all the single people, whatever their denomination is, you know, get them together and meet each other and dance and celebrate and have the feast, you know.
Absolutely.
So that's my big picture.
No, absolutely. And I don't think you can be human without some sense of, like, what happens to you when you've experienced that. I mean, I don't know why this is what's coming to mind for me. I could probably guess at it if I had to, but Nick Cave has written a lot about the suffering in his life. You know, his two sons who die, and this comes at a time in life. It leads him back to church or to church. And one of the things that Cave will talk a lot about, really, really poetically and powerfully, is that when you're standing outside of suffering, you're experiencing it one way. But when you actually suffer, you're able to suffer it in a way you couldn't have imagined you would be able to. Not that the suffering itself is good. You know, we were talking earlier, you made this point about the anomaly. And I think that part of the reason suffering works, sometimes turns out to be the occasion of good, is not because the thing itself that happens to you, mm-hmm. in his case, the death of his sons. Of course, that's only bad. But because it's an occurrence in this world, it's an occurrence inside of the play that God is making, it has the element, if nothing else, if everything else about it is wrong, it has the element of mystery. It interrupts. It's an anomaly. And if that's all that is good about it, that is good about it. And it allows, if everything else is wrong, that isn't wrong. The interruption, the mystery, the anomaly, that itself is what allows for a reframing, a stepping back to see the whole. And sometimes, often, nothing else will make us stop and step back except that kind of interruption. And it hopefully doesn't have to be something horrific, as in his case. But even when it is, the people that actually suffer it are grateful for it. If they're able to step back, and Cave is a great example of this, they're not grateful for the death of their sons, of course. They're grateful for the ways in which suffering that included within it the interruption to what life had become, to what where they were living, that allowed for a stepping back and a coming aware. And it ought not take that. It ought not take that. But if it does, it does. And I think part of what we need to listen to more are the people that actually live it. And in our world, there are too many of us talking about things we haven't actually lived. And in abstraction, things are different than they are in concrete lived reality. Mm-hmm. And they're both, I think we need to live it and speak from within sight of it. And I think this, you know, what you're suggesting here is, you know, a good reminder that we can't know these things from outside. We just can't. That's not how human beings know.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's a good place to wrap up. I think we, believe it or not, we tied together the ambiguous 771, the cosmos as play, and Jordan Daniel Wood's essay on, what was the title of his essay?
Oh, it's I don't even know if I can quote it off the top of my head, but it's about incarnation and creation in Maximus Confessor, the Logos and the Logos.
Yes, yes.
So it's some version of that title and subtitle. The William Brown piece, for those who we mentioned it, but those who might want to read it, it's a wonderful take on Proverbs and the image of Christ as the little child, who that creation is this play of Christ. It's a wonderful piece too, and it ties really nicely to what Maximus says in 71.
I'll put links to all those in the description section. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been very enlivening, and also gives us a good idea of what you might want to talk with Dr. McGilchrist about when the time rolls around. So thank you very much for joining me, and have a wonderful week.
Yeah, let's talk soon, Karen. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.